Welcome to Fit Friends Happy Hour, a podcast about all things nutrition, fitness, and life in your 20s and 30s, all from a non-diet lens. I'm your host, Katie Hake, and I'm a registered dietitian nutritionist and certified personal trainer. Join me here every week as I talk with interesting people and experts from all walks of life about their relationship with food, exercise, and their bodies. I am on a mission to help you redefine the word fit, to help you stop quantifying and start living. Learn to stop measuring your success by the scale and find your fears. Macy, I'm so excited, number one, to catch up with you, but also via podcast.
Yes, so excited.
So Macy and I go back, fellow Boilermakers, you know, we share the same passion for fitness, but why don't you tell everybody just, you know, your story and your background and where it's led you to where you are today?
Absolutely. So I grew up a ballet dancer. So I was pre-professional ballet dancer for probably 10 or 15 years. Really didn't know anything about fitness at all. And so I came to Purdue and I was no longer a dancer. And I was like, you know, I really want to make sure I'm staying active, I'm staying fit, because I really enjoyed being active, the active aspects of dance. And so I came to Purdue and I started taking fitness classes. And I always joke that when I had an instructor tell me to do a burpee, I thought I just threw myself to the floor and figured out how to get my booty back up. And so I remember I was taking classes. I really loved turbo kick. And I was taking all these classes and just looked like a hooligan in the back. And then eventually, after taking all these classes, someone had come up to me and they said, hey, you should be an instructor. And I was like, I'm just messing around back here. Like, I'm just having a good time, like, whatever. And then fast forward, and I ended up getting my turbo kick certification with the most amazing master trainer.
Oh, stop.
and just really embraced it and, like, went out of my comfort zone and really just, like, threw myself into being an instructor and, like, really found this passion for fitness that I had and didn't really know that I had. And so I was really, really throwing myself into that. And then I eventually went way out of my comfort zone and became a personal trainer. And even though it was definitely a different aspect of fitness, it was something that I was able to connect more one-on-one with people and really, really see their progress versus in a class setting where it's like you might see someone some week and you might not see them for 3 or 4 more weeks. So it's really great to, like, be able to feel like I had an impact long-term on each individual client. And all the while I was in my nursing program, and I got into Purdue's nursing program, which is quite challenging, as any nursing program is. And I wasn't, and people always ask me, like, if I always wanted to be a nurse, and I will not even lie. There was a point in time when I was 3 years into my program and I wasn't sure.
I feel like there's many people who went to Purdue can relate to that, of like getting to that point, absolutely, sophomore, junior year, where you're like, this sucks, I don't know what I'm doing.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. Kind of like this imposter syndrome. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And I really loved the things that I was learning and being in the gym and really feeling like people, the really hard part about nursing is you have a lot of chronic and on-chronic populations, much like dietetics. Mm-hmm. And the really hard part of that is the reality is you're trying as much as you can to impact people that maybe don't care if you have an impact, or that they don't care if they ever want to change. They have chronic low back pain and really they just want to say, cut me open and make me better.
Right. Or they believe that that's the only way that they have absolutely to deal with the pain long-term, or.
Right. Yeah. And so I really had what I was seeing in my clinical, I was having a lot of moral and ethical dilemmas of like, this isn't what I want my impact to look like forever. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of went back to the drawing board and I asked myself, what do I like? What do I enjoy? And I always came back to fitness. I always came back to fitness. And so I really liked the idea of movement as medicine. And so I was really, really, really fixated on that almost. And so I decided maybe I want to be a physical therapist. And so I was researching and was really involved and decided that I was going to go to physical therapy school after I graduated. But the reality is Purdue is a direct admit nursing program. So I didn't have a lot of entry-level prereqs because you hit the ground running and I'm in 200 and 300 level courses as a freshman. Mm-hmm. And so by the time I'm all the way into my nursing program, pretty much my entire transcript is nursing classes, which is a really great benefit to a direct admit nursing program. But a huge con of that is if you change your mind, you have to almost start all the way over.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward to almost the very end, I took the summer of my junior year. I had applied to about 20 internships. Wow. Did not get a single one for nursing. And I said, you know, maybe this is the world's way of saying this isn't for you. And that's totally fine. And so I took that entire summer. I did 120 observation hours completely unpaid. I actually got a scholarship and I was working in research. And so I worked, I think, 95 hours over the summer in research, and they paid for my summer courses. And I took all of the science prereqs to be able to apply for PT school.
Ooh, I feel like so many people can relate to that. Like you said, that point in your career where you're just like, how do I stay motivated? How do I keep going with what it is that I thought I wanted to do when I've got this huge roadblock? So what happened kind of after that summer?
So after that, I'm in the last year of my nursing program because I didn't change my major. I said, you know what, I'm going to honor the commitment that I have made to myself as well as to healthcare of, you know, I'm going to finish what I started. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in my last year. I'm not only going through the challenges of a senior year nursing schedule, working as a personal trainer, working as a fitness instructor, and I was a lead personal trainer or fitness instructor at that time, and absolutely loving all of those aspects and applying to a graduate program. And so flying out for interviews, doing all of these things, all the while in November of that year, I had hip surgery as a 22-year-old.
Side note.
Exactly. And it's like, so I remember just like in the moment, it was like, I felt like every single day I was making a decision that was going to impact the next 20 or 30 years of my life. Mm-hmm. And so that was incredibly heavy. And it was one of those things that it was like, you tell yourself, like, you have to push, you have to push, you have to push. And then you sit down at the end of the day and you just feel like all you've done is been stimulated with these decisions that you're not going to know the long-term consequences, but you had to make them. And so you have to be like confident in that, like, you know what's best for yourself.
Yeah. Decision fatigue is a real thing.
Oh my gosh. 100%. 100%. So I end up going through all of the application process, which, as you know, applying to programs and internships is very stressful, but it's
another full-time job.
Exactly. And it's also, they kind of make their own rules. Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to figure out, like, this program has this set of rules and an application that's not here, actually. It's also somewhere else, and you have to fill out everything here too. So filled out all my applications, and I had two schools that I had interviews with. And the interview process for those that have applied to graduate programs is usually around October to December, around the time I was having my hip surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So wonderful. What a fantastic time to be traveling by yourself, right? So I actually received an interview with Mayo Clinic's program in Rochester, and I flew out to Rochester, Minnesota, and I'd never been to Minnesota in my entire life outside of driving through it. When my family, we have a trip we do to Canada, we would drive through it, but it was in the morning part, so I slept through it. I'd literally never seen the state of Minnesota. So I fly there in, I believe it was December, and I land, and there's probably 3 feet of snow on the ground.
You're like, what did I get myself into?
Exactly. Oh my goodness. And so I go through the interview. I fall in love with this program. I absolutely love everything they're telling me, but also the fact that they're telling me that I need to make the decision that's good for me, and that might not be their program. And they're very, very forthcoming with a lot of information, as well as treating us like people instead of like prospects,
mm-hmm.
which was really fantastic. And I interviewed for another program and I was waitlisted for both of them. And so I kind of had to just sit back and let the decisions go out of my hands. So I went from this position of you are making all these serious decisions to wait and wait.
Which is never good for the person who likes to do all the things, everything, all the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really hard to go to the complete opposite in a matter of, you know, a week or a day.
I shouldn't say never good. I should say never easy.
It is very challenging. It is very challenging. So I end up waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And I come to the end of my nursing program and I'm still waiting. And then I find out that I was admitted to one of the programs. And I, at the point, it was the other program. So it wasn't my spot at Mayo Clinic that I was hoping for, but it was another really great program. And so now I'm like, this is what I wanted. This is what I've been working for this entire time. And I press pause and realize that I need to be 100% sure if I'm willing to put this much time, money, effort into what I'm working for. Mm-hmm. And the reality was I kind of came to the conclusion that the program would not let me defer for a year. And so I came to the decision that I need to be 100% sure, and I wasn't. And I put all this work into it, and it was something that I still love the idea of, but isn't where I've kind of grown to love my career where it is.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very challenging decision to come to, but it was definitely something that was important to realize.
I think that takes a lot of courage, though, when we're so young and don't feel like we have a lot of experience and we're not really confident in ourselves, you know, to make that kind of decision of, okay, this is not working out like I hoped, but the courage to do what feels right for you and your gut, and not versus, well, everybody says you need to go to grad school and do this and XYZ and check these boxes in order to make this money and do these things in order to be successful. So, like,
absolutely.
Virtual high five to you for that right there.
Thank you. I felt like I had worked for all of these things, and I kept having my dad be like, so why didn't you just take a year off? Take a year as a nurse, figure out what you want. And I was like, if I don't go to school now, I'm never going to go back. I'm never going to want to, like, all of these things. And don't tell my parents, but they were 100% right. Even just taking a year isn't that hard to do.
Right. Goes by fast.
And at the time, you're like, it's a whole year, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But that was definitely something that I needed to do. So I never heard about placement in Rochester's program at Mayo Clinic, but I felt like I had this calling to Minnesota, even though there was so much snow on the ground that you couldn't even see the ground. And it was so incredibly cold. I felt like I had this calling to Mayo Clinic. And so fast forward to the very end of my program, and everyone's applying. Some were applying to programs for nurse practitioner, or they were finding out they had jobs and placement. And I'm sitting here just waiting still. And so I was like, you know what? If I feel like this is where my calling is to be, for whatever reason, I'm going to figure out what that's going to look like with the options I can have a little bit of a say in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied to my very first job and I got it. And I sat through, I think it was a 6-hour interview.
Oh my.
And it was, I usually am kind of the person where it's like, I get done with a phone call and I'm like, I really don't know how that went. Like, it's fine. I'll wait until I hear back. But this was, I had such an amazing experience, even talking with the HR representative. He would ask me a question and he would say, you know, I'm looking at your resume and I'm hearing you say that you're a doer, but I want to hear more about you. And so I mean, he gave me some really amazing tips, like, to this day that I could use to help further my career. And I really had an amazing experience with my manager, and he's fantastic. So I graduated in May of 2019, and I've now almost been in the field for an entire year. And my patient population I work with is orthopedic trauma and neurosurgery. So we kind of see a little bit of everything, but our main population, we have orthopedic spine. So we'll have people that will have elective spine surgeries, or we'll see a lot of women patients that have had breast cancer that's migrated to their spine. So they'll have tumor debulkings, or they'll remove the entire spinal cage and basically construct a spine out of titanium.
so cool because, I mean, that's an area that you may have never necessarily wound up in if you took that traditional route. And here it is. It is kind of integrated to functional movement and just the power of medicine with that as well. So tell us, you know, what that first year has been like, because, you know, for here you are moving to yet again, a new city, a new career. That doesn't sound like an easy area to understand. I'm sure you have to know, you know, on top of that, I'm sure your fitness background helped with, you know, the anatomy piece of it. And of course, nursing, but what was that first year like with your first job? Sounds stressful.
Absolutely. So 1 year, almost 1 year in, and I have seen so many things that I never had expected to be a challenge whatsoever. Mm. And so my floor, actually the unit was brand new. So we had built this new building and they had never actually, this floor hadn't existed 2 years ago. And so our sister unit is dedicated specifically to neurosurgery. And so we're more of the neurospine component and they're more of the neurobrain component. And so because my unit was so new, I actually did my orientation. That's about 12 weeks long. I did my orientation for half of it on our sister unit. So for the entire first period, I was working on a unit that I was really, it really wasn't my home, quote unquote. So you have a different culture, you have a different manager, you have a different patient population, but you have some of our same population. So same, but not, but I was seeing a lot. Some of my hardest days, even looking back on it, were during my orientation period. And I would get in my car, and I am not an emotional person, but I remember getting in my car and calling my parents and telling them that I love them and like just bawling, because you have a lot of things that happen that are just fluke instances or anything from someone who's tried to take their own life, and you're doing everything you can to save it. And you're seeing so many things, like so many of the lows of people's lives. You're in the room when they're told that they have terminal cancer and that like they may never see outside the four walls in their life again. And so you're the one that's there. You're the one holding their hand when the doctor leaves. And a lot of the first year is you're still learning. And I still, to this day, I'm constantly asking questions. I'm constantly going out of my way to try and learn more, which can be incredibly uncomfortable. And I always feel like a lot of the hard parts of nursing or healthcare at all is being able to say, I don't know. And even as someone, I know. And even as someone who comes out of school and you think that like, wow, I have all this power. I passed my boards. Like I have the world at my fingertips. And to be in a place where you are surrounded by some of the greatest minds. One of our consultants is one of three people in the entire world that does his surgery.
That's crazy.
And he makes a presence on the floor and he will show up and talk to you and say, are you the nurse that's gonna be caring for my patient? And he'll be throwing all these things at you that he wants. And you have to be able to say, okay, what is that you're wanting? I don't actually know. And you have to just kind of like bite your ego a little bit and say, it's okay that I don't know, because in the long run, it's going to be better for my patient.
Right. I think that's challenging. Anybody listening who has worked, especially in the healthcare field, but also just with other people in general, it's humbling. And I think it's really hard that first year, at least for me, it was to kind of go, oh my gosh, I need to separate these two and I need to learn how to protect my own space, because we take everything on like so personally and so heavy, and it's exhausting. And we're going to get into this episode later talking about fast forward to July of 2020 and COVID and craziness. But before we go there, I want to share a little bit more. What did/does a typical day-to-day look like for you, you know, as a nurse working side by side with people in that unit?
Absolutely. So I usually start my mornings. I'll work a 12-hour shift. So I'll work 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. when I'm on days, and when I'm on nights, it's 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. And so I'll usually start my mornings around 4:30, 5 o'clock, getting up, waking up, getting my food that I may not have time to sit down and actually eat, but making my food, getting everything set up, getting everything put in my bag. And the unfortunate part about where I work is that if you haven't worked there for approximately 25 or 30 years, you can't actually park at the hospital. Ever.
Yes, I can relate. I can relate to, I always joke that I've parked like in the foot, we call it football field, where I'm like far away.
Yeah.
It's a hike just to get to your work. Yeah.
So what they do for us is they'll have like satellite shuttle options. So you will drive to these, they're usually locations that Mayo Clinic has purchased, mm-hmm. and they've purchased the lot as maybe like a shutdown strip mall. They'll just buy the whole parking lot. And they'll use it for employees. Something that's really fortunate that I have access to is my apartment complex offers a complimentary shuttle. And the con to that is it means I have to be on the shuttle at 6 o'clock, and they are so timely, it hurts.
Oh, wow.
And they are there at 6 o'clock on the dot. And if anyone is listening that knows me, you can almost bank that I'm always 15 minutes late.
I unfortunately can relate to that all too well.
Yes. And so I have been that crazy person in my snow gear and my
your
hat,
parka,
my gloves, running through the parking lot, like waving my hands, like, please don't leave me.
Oh, no.
And it stops. And of course, everyone's like, oh, this girl again. Okay, you're late. We get it. But I got to get to work. So that's kind of like the unfortunate side of like my days. When I'm on days, they run a little bit earlier, but I'm adjusting and I'm trying. Mm-hmm. I am actively trying. But so you get in and you look up your patients and you kind of see what your day is going to look like. And I always joke that you can sit down on your morning, you're sipping on your coffee, you don't have anything going on yet because you haven't taken your report on your patients. You're sitting down, you're looking your patients up like, okay, here's my plan. Here's that 8:30, these are the meds that are due for these separate patients, and so on and so forth. And, you know, on your board, you're thinking, okay, is this patient discharging? Are they going to surgery? Do they have any tests scheduled that I need to be aware of? And so, and also looking up any notes, anything that's been pertinent overnight. Okay, did we call a code on this patient? Did we have to transfer them to an ICU and they're coming back, kind of a thing?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're trying, you're planning and you're planning and planning. You're like, okay, let's have a great day. And as soon as you step on the floor, you can throw your plan right out the window because it does not matter. And as much as, and like, we are all planners, I feel like everyone in this healthcare field, in nursing in particular, we're all very type A for the most part. And we love to have a plan and we love to execute that plan as perfectly as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is the days just don't go that way. And so you have to prioritize. Maybe you have a family member that's standing in front of you and they think it is absolutely urgent that you come in and fluff their patient's pillows.
Mm-hmm.
And you have another patient that's down the hall that's in a pain crisis that is screaming out the window for pain medicine. Or you have another patient that's like, I feel like I can't really breathe right now. And you're like, okay, you could be having a heart attack and this could all be happening at the same time. And you have to be the one to set your limits and say, I'm sorry, the patient, your pillows aren't fluffed well enough. Please hit your light. Someone else will come help you. I have other emergencies. And I have such a hard time, like even you learn prioritization in school, but I have a really hard time standing and looking at someone and saying someone else is more important, essentially. Mm-hmm. That is really hard for me to be able to say that and limit, you know, what I can personally do.
Mm-hmm. That people pleasing tendencies.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, you go through your day and you're prioritizing, you're doing these things. You're trying to do everything on time, but the reality is some meds are going to be late. You know, you're giving medications that are incredibly hazardous. You're doing a lot of things really fast, but you have to be good at doing them very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll just be 100% honest. I was during my orientation with my preceptor, I programmed an epidural pump wrong.
Yeah.
And that's something that is very scary. And a lot of nurses will.
So what does that mean? Explain that to the non-medical listener. Like,
yeah,
put that in a layman's terms.
Absolutely. So we have a very, some of our really, really intense patients will go through 5 or 6 stage procedures and mm-hmm. they'll have a surgery and they'll recover in a day. And they'll go in and do the surgery again.
Because people are like, whoa, isn't epidural like if you're having a baby?
Exactly. So it's the same idea. And this actually was a pediatric patient. They were under 18. And it was very scary for me. But the fortunate aspect of, so the epidural was already placed. So it is actually a wire that, and if you're going to have a baby, you're probably like, Macy, I don't want to hear this. Mute me. But
it's trigger warning.
Wire. Exactly. It's a wire that is placed with a needle, and the anesthesiologist will place this. Usually it'll be while they're being monitored, because a lot of the medications that we're giving, the pain medications, have a lot of adverse effects. Like, they'll quickly drop your blood pressure, and it can be a really big problem. So things like that, that are things that you're always watching for. But when they come to our floor, they've already recovered, and they know that, first of all, the epidural is in the right spot, and the anesthesiologist that placed it has made sure that the dosing and everything that they're giving you is stable enough to keep monitoring the patient. Mm-hmm. And so the error that happened, that I was working with my preceptor and I was side by side, and it was kind of a learning point for me that I had to kind of like come to grasp with. It was my hands that was doing, I was the one that was doing this. And the way that your orientation works, it actually falls on my preceptor and her license. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm fresh out of school and I'm just freaking out when someone comes and tells me, hey, you just programmed this epidural wrong on a patient that's under 18. And so that just,
so basically meaning you dosed them too much medicine or not enough, or that could have really major consequences.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And so fortunate for me, we had actually underdosed the patient, mm-hmm. regardless of the fact that it was on the safer side of an error. I still had to notify the pain management consultant. I had to go all the way to the top of this service, the big guy that's been working in the hospital for 20 or 30 years, and say, hey, I made an error on this pediatric patient. And you have to monitor them as well as doing all of these other things, filling out an incident report, everything like that. And so the reason that this happened, I know, was 100% me. I have nowhere else that I can place blame other than myself. And so you're looking at this, it's a bag of a fluid. And so you're looking at this concentration of your solvent as well as your solution. And so you're looking at a concentration of a concentration that you're wanting to titrate and dilute to be a different concentration when it enters the body. And so you're also programming this into basically a baby computer that's going to pump this drip by drip. So mm-hmm. if you see old school nurses, or even in nursing school, they still teach you how to concentrate different things by a drip factor, which is how many drips are coming out of that tube per second. So you'll see old school nurses that don't need pumps and they're just doing all this craziness. And like, I find that so impressive. I use a computer and I still mess up sometimes.
Sure.
So I programmed the pump, and I kept asking my preceptor, I was like, hey, can you just pull it up on the computer? I want to double check. And she was like, no, you're right, it's fine. And kept saying that. And I really, looking back on it, I should have been more persistent and said, no, let's just pull it up for sure.
Right.
And I could have potentially avoided an error. But luckily in this situation, we contacted the pain management service, and they actually said, well, I'm really glad that she's doing well enough that she is, because we had completed almost probably 6 hours of a bed bath and doing a lot of other things. And she felt like she was able to kind of feel her legs a little bit more. And she was also more comfortable with being able to feel her legs a little bit more, even though she might have been in a little bit more pain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So luckily it worked out in the patient's favor, but that is the reality, is if I had gone the other direction, it could have had some very, very serious consequences. Mm-hmm. And this is all the while you have other patients and other things that are on your mind, that are kind of in the back of your mind, that are going on, that you're, once I leave this room, I'm doing X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
So
very fast paced setting, and realizing that it's okay to say, I don't know. So your day is primarily spent dosing medication, like just a wide variety of everything you think of somebody who's in the hospital, out of surgery, like what one person goes through. You have to do that for what, 5 people, 10 people, just depends.
Right, absolutely. And the very fortunate part of the fact that our floor is heavy, meaning you're in there doing a lot of cares. And if you're not staffed well, that's a serious problem. But our floor does a really, really great job of staffing to our numbers, but also knowing the acuity of our floor, being we are a step down unit. meaning they're coming straight from the ICU to us, or they're coming straight from surgery to us. They do a very good job of knowing that that means they're very heavy cares. But the other aspect to that is, being a spine population, a lot of people will use ceiling lifts to lift up heavy patients, whether that's repositioning them in bed, getting them out of bed, getting them into bed, anything like that. We don't have the ability to use the ceiling lifts, even if you have a 300, 400 pound patient, because it will increase the intracranial pressure. So the pressure that stabilizes your brain. And if you've just manipulated the nerves and the connective tissues of the neurological system, you put them at risk for a cerebrospinal fluid leak, which is another serious issue. Yeah. So ceiling lifts are off limits. It is all strictly manpower.
Oh my gosh.
And so as a result of that, I'm 125 pound female lifting patients that are three or four times my size.
Right.
And so you fast forward to, in the winter of my first year, I had a back injury that I am still dealing with to this day. And it is just some of like the craziest things in the world. And being a very young, new unit, we are seeing a lot of injuries in male and female nurses because of just the risk of injury in our specific population.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So a lot of not just mental and emotional stress. There's definitely some physical stress as well. So
absolutely.
So fast forward to March of 2020, how has COVID impacted, you know, your career? Let's talk about your career first. And then I also want to get into talking about, right, like working in the healthcare system.
Yes.
How do you protect yourself? So tell us how your position changed and what that has looked like for you.
Yeah. So early on, at first it was like, nothing's changed. It's all kind of the calm before the storm. My manager actually sat on the board that was almost like the infectious disease board of the hospital. And in February and March, they were meeting every single day, sitting at a round table at a giant conference table. And they were sitting there for 8 or 10 hours. And so my manager was sitting on this board. So I knew I had really good information. If I really needed information, I had access to it. And so I had a patient that had a lot that was going on, but no one could really figure it out. And in the back of my mind, I'd been listening to COVID everything since about December.
December?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, man. You guys, Macy's an expert. I'll share a story that I had in a second, but okay, go ahead and finish. So
I remember I'd heard about this. I knew what it was. I had a grasp. I shouldn't say I knew. I had a grasp on what this was. And I knew that it was something that I didn't want to mess with, because I knew some of the greatest minds in the world were saying, we don't actually know. And so I was like, I'm not going to mess with this. But I had a patient that in about March said, we were having these issues. His flu results had come back negative. And so in the back of my mind, I was like, okay, well, what about COVID? And so I asked my manager, I said, regionally, this could be a possibility within the United States, but for patient privacy, I won't say like where. But I had gone to my manager and I said, I think that this is something we should look into. Can we get a test? This was at the point also where we were saying, tests are really important. Let's talk about that. And he said, we were very quiet and we definitely kept the conversation to ourselves. And he said, there is not a single test on site at Mayo Clinic. And I said, you mean to tell me we're the number one hospital in the world and we don't have anything? And so that was definitely like kind of like opened my eyes. And this was at the early development stages where Mayo Clinic was like, we need to make our own test because we don't have any. And so we didn't have a single one. And that was kind of like the tip of the iceberg where I was like, okay, this is going to be interesting.
So you kind of had this in the back of your mind, like, oh, something might be coming of this. So this was probably, oh my goodness, this would have been sometime in March, maybe the second week in March. I had gone into work and I had my bridal shower that weekend before, and come Monday, you know, I get to work on Monday and my now sister-in-law sent me a text and gave me a call. And she said, hey, we just found out that my dad's coworker tested positive for this COVID thing. So I don't know. I'm going to tell my boss. I don't really know, but I feel like we should probably say something. And so I said, okay, I've heard of it, but I really know nothing about it. And so I said something to my boss, and my boss said, you need to go home now until we don't know when. And I was like, huh? What? And so I literally had to like quietly pack my stuff up and leave because I didn't even know what to explain to people. And so I had to stay home for, I think, 2 days. And then I went back to work. And then it was that following Monday, that's when they sent everybody to go home. And here we've been since then. So it's just, it's interesting hearing just how like the healthcare field was even like, we don't know what's happening. We don't know what to do. She had no protocol. She just said, you need to leave. I was like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think that like my opinion is being very different from those of my employer, but felt like in that moment, I felt like, how can we be this unprepared? Like, how could we be in this position? And I think mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. Mayo as a whole, I think they definitely handled everything very well on the flip side of it, of putting together a board of people and being able to say, we're going to sit down every day for this long until we figure it out. And so I think that a lot of places weren't able mm-hmm. to do that, mm-hmm. didn't have the resources or didn't, you know, act in the same way. And it was something that I felt so incredibly blessed to work where I do through all of this. They very quickly initiated a mask policy. They have very quickly figured out a test and have constantly been changing that to match what we're seeing in clinical practice, which is amazing of them.
Mm-hmm. So surgeries, of course, stopped at some point. So walk us through that, what that was like, you know, with your job, because I know you had some time off and it was like pros and cons. So talk to us about that, what that looked like.
Yeah. So being a large part of our population, being spine in particular, our traumas are definitely, that's not elective. But our spine population, there is a certain percentage that would be considered elective 100%. Our traumas, our larger traumas, they ended up going to our trauma floors or trauma ICU, and they slowly...
The trauma would be, like, what would be the difference between trauma, you know, someone who has a trauma injury versus like needed an elective surgery?
Yeah, absolutely. So our traumas are a car accident and I break my leg, I break my arm, anything that has something else that has caused it. So you could even be looking at someone who has fallen and broken their arm. That's going to be considered a trauma, because you also have to consider, okay, did they hit their head? Do I need to be worried about head stuff? Do I need to be worried about, you know, X, Y, and Z? And you also have to be watching for, you know, other bleeding in other mm-hmm. parts of the body too. So our orthopedic population that is elective is going to be more of, you know, I have a ligament in my arm that needs to be reconnected to somewhere else. Or I have, in my case, I would be considered an elective orthopedic patient when I had my hip surgery. I had been in pain for 8+ years before I had this surgery. And so I went in and they had done some reconnecting and some shaving of some bone kind of a thing. But it would be considered elective, even though it was dramatically impacting my life, it was still considered elective.
Mm-hmm.
And so the governor of Minnesota was very involved, and as an unfortunate effect of why he is so involved, his brother had actually passed away from COVID in the early parts of this period. And so he has been very, very involved in trying to protect oh, wow. people from going through what he went through. And so he basically put a pause on everything. Mm-hmm. Any semi-urgent procedure. Basically, if you were not dying and they were not operating directly from the Mayo One choppers or from the emergency room, you weren't having surgery. It did not matter. And we have some of our urgent cases that, you know, people mm-hmm. that break their hardware in their spine and it's now pushing on their spinal cord, which is a big emergency, they weren't having surgery. We have our cancer population that they're looking at a time clock of their life, very unfortunately. They were told you have to wait. Everyone was told everything was put on pause. We were having people that were having heart attacks and they were trying to stage how far into this heart attack are they? Do we need to take them to the cath lab? Do we need to do any form of sedation? Can it wait? Mm. And so that was put on pause for a long period of time. And so my unit closed. We were completely closed. We closed probably the last weekend in March. And so what that means for me, it's not, okay, you can go home, see you later, Macy. It means we need your hands somewhere else in the hospital. Hey, we're going to send you to this unit that you know nothing about the patient population. Mm-hmm. You know nothing about their policies. You know nothing about the way they run their unit. But you're going to go there and you're going to go for 4 hours for now. Mm-hmm. But we might say in 4 hours, report off for your patients and we're going to send you somewhere else. And you might do that 3 times in your 12-hour shift.
Oh, my.
And so you're not only juggling learning what the heck is going on, like where is the ground, where are my feet, but you're mm-hmm. potentially doing that multiple times a day mm-hmm. and you don't know. You just don't know. You show up to work and you don't know where you're going to go. And usually mm-hmm. you're probably the one going, where's the bathroom? I finally have a bathroom break. Where do I even go to the bathroom? And so we did that for weeks mm-hmm. and weeks. And so usually they try and send you to a similar population. So a lot of times they try to send us to our sister floor, which is also just chronically understaffed, which has kind of worked out great in our favor. But then our sister unit closed, and then another orthopedic mm-hmm. floor closed, and then another trauma floor closed. So I have no other options. Like I have nowhere of my quote unquote specialty mm-hmm. that I could go. So that means I'm getting sent to a general med floor. I'm getting sent to the COVID floor. I'm getting sent to the vent unit. I'm getting sent to the pediatric unit, and I'm getting sent all over the place and trying to figure out not only what's going on, but what is the current policy? What is the current PPE situation? What are we doing for this new thing that we don't understand? How am I being protected? And so we did that for a long period of time, which was very hard for myself as well as my coworkers. Because the reality is it's incredibly anxiety provoking, but you're also in the back of your mind, your patients have the TV on and it's talking about COVID 24/7. Your homepage on your computer is COVID 24/7. You open your phone and it's COVID everywhere and you can't escape it. There's no escaping it.
So how were you, it's like, it feels like we're in this different chapter of it, but also same time not. So one thing that I said to Macy, you know, before this interview, just throughout this whole time, I'm like, you've been so positive throughout everything. And it's interesting to hear just your journey in the healthcare field, because I think people think, oh, front lines, it's just people who are caring for COVID, like just mm-hmm. on that floor, but it's really impacting everybody. Like if you or someone you know is not impacted by this pandemic, you're wrong. It's literally impacting everyone everywhere. So with it being in your face 24/7, oh my gosh, that's how I feel. And I'm not even remotely close to your situation. What have you been able to do to keep your brain space okay and take care of yourself?
Yeah. And that's something that I will say, like, it has taken time. And towards the end of when I was floating to all these different units, I was finding that as soon as I was getting to work, I was just so full of anxiety and it was making me angry. And, mm-hmm. and it was constantly, you know, you're from mm-hmm. another unit, you're coming onto a unit where they have their own culture. They're all friends, or they're maybe not all friends, but you're coming on and they want to know, what are you guys doing? You know, what's your policy? What are you guys going to do in April and May, what's going on? And so it's like, people are coming almost at you with like, what's going on? And you're just like, I want to hang out in my corner. I want
Don't
to
talk
shut
to
out
me.
The entire, exactly. Like
let
I
me
want
do
to
my
shut
job.
Out the entire world. Yes. Ugh. And so like some of my last few float experiences, the workload was not exhausting. It was COVID was exhausting. And the worry that it creates and the things that are known mm-hmm. are scary, but the question marks are always scarier. And so that was something that I really struggled with, was just even going to work, like, or mm-hmm. I'm going to a sister unit to a COVID unit, or I'm on a COVID unit and I have a COVID rule out patient that I might leave the unit and find out in 2 days, they might give me a call and say, hey, actually they had COVID. So those are things you have to like worry about just walking in someone's room, because at this point we were saying everyone is a COVID patient unless we hear otherwise. And so, and they really, every hospital, I think, wanted to have this idea of let's have a clean floor. Let's have a floor where we know everyone is negative. But the reality is, the reality of the incubation and how this virus works is that's not always possible.
Wow. Interesting.
Or really at all. And so I ended up, I think I ended up calling in for a shift because I had to take care of myself. And I was not in a space where I was like, let's be positive. Let's figure out what we know. Absolutely. I was on the complete other side of that world. I was like, self-preservation, man. I got to take care of myself. And that is all I can do for today.
Right.
And so I ended up, I think I called in for one shift and I felt incredibly bad for like almost like abandoning my patients. But I felt like if I'm not taking care of myself, I can't take care of anybody else. If I can't emotionally handle it and get myself together, how am I going to help my patients who are sitting in their room 24/7 because they can't walk, they can't get in the hallway, they can't do whatever. So all they're doing is watching like COVID Central. And so I have to also be there because they're saying, hey, in your professional opinion, what the heck is going on?
Yeah. Right. Oh my gosh. Well, thank you for sharing that. Just being honest of like, I called in sick because it's so true and it's so important. And so often we feel bad, and I'm hearing a theme here of like, I have had to learn how to not be a people pleaser, and it's okay to not be okay. And it's okay to admit that. And it's okay to do things that displease others. You have to put yourself first sometimes.
Absolutely.
Okay. I hope by hearing Macy's story that you're starting to really feel some hope that, okay, maybe I don't have to feel so much in a funk about this whole pandemic. And maybe there are ways that I can filter how I'm feeling about it in a way that helps me feel informed, but also helps me feel empowered, and not the opposite where we can sometimes feel overwhelmed and hopeless. So stay tuned. Make sure you're subscribed because you won't want to miss part two of this episode. Macy really breaks down a little bit more of the science behind COVID-19. She gives us some actual strategies, not just coping, but how we can filter the media and really help empower you to make those decisions around your health that are going to do and feel what's right for you. And if you haven't already, be sure to join us over on Facebook. Just click the link in the show notes and request to join our private Facebook community, where we talk about each episode, and really it's a space for you to feel connected, supported by other fierce females who are in this journey going through the same thing as you. All right, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Fit Friends Happy Hour. If you liked this episode, don't forget to share it with a friend. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook at Fit Friends Happy Hour. Talk to you next time.